From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In all his plays, August Wilson examined the experience of African Americans in this country during the 20th century. In fact, he wrote one play for every decade of the century. The scholar Sandra Shannon says Wilson wasn't interested in blaming white America for its treatment of black people. He wanted to examine the emotional scars left behind. And so you have these wounded and conflicted characters in his plays, like Troy Maxson in the play Fences. He's a black garbage man who is proud but also angry about his circumstances. Today in the program, we're talking about August Wilson and Fences, which has just opened at the Pioneer Theater Company in Salt Lake City. Sandra Shannon calls Wilson a prophet of his race who resurrects crucial moments in history to inspire his people to adjust their attitude and their spirit. Join us after the news.
Support for Radio West comes from thousands of sustainers, listeners just like you who give ongoing monthly donations to help pay for the public radio shows they rely on. Show your love for Radio West by becoming a sustainer, starting at just $5 a month at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. August Wilson's play Fences isn't autobiographical, not necessarily, but it is built around a character who has a turbulent relationship with his son, not unlike Wilson's relationship with his own father. The play, which won a Pulitzer Prize, has one of American theater's great characters, Troy Maxson. He's a black garbage man living in an American city in the years before civil rights. He was a gifted baseball player, but Troy's window of opportunity to make it came before the color barrier was broken. And so he's left bitter, but proud. He's a great talker, and he always has a story or a tirade. His wife, Rose, doesn't say much. She knows when Troy walks into a room, he fills it up. The problem is he doesn't make room for her. Fences just opened at the Pioneer Theater Company. A film version of the play, directed and starring Denzel Washington, is now playing in theaters around the country. Wilson, who died in 2005, wrote the screenplay. Today in the program, we're talking about Fences and about August Wilson's work. Sandra Shannon is with us, a scholar of African-American literature. She teaches English at Howard University in Washington, D.C. Professor Shannon has written widely on August Wilson. Her books include The Dramatic Vision of August Wilson. She's joining us from the studios of NPR in Washington. Professor Shannon, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
And she's there alongside Bob Mondello, who is, of course, NPR's arts and film critic. He's a longtime theater critic also in Washington and joining us again. Bob, good to hear your voice again.
Great to be here.
And Timothy Douglas is with us through the hour. He's director of Fences for the Pioneer Theater Company. It's his fourth time directing the play. He's directed 9 of Wilson's 10 plays. He's based in New York City, directs around the country, just started a new project in Portland, Oregon. That's where he's joining us from a studio there. Timothy Douglas, welcome to you.
Thank you.
I want to begin, I guess, with some broad perspective. And Professor Shannon, you and Bob Mondello, to this question, put August Wilson's work, you know, his larger sense of work, the significance of his work in perspective, if you would. Bob, you start.
Well, I think August Wilson is arguably one of the two, conceivably three great playwrights in American history. I think what he has accomplished with the 10 play decalogue or century cycle or whatever you want to call it, which is a play for each decade in the 20th century, is certainly the most ambitious project ever attempted in American theater and is a remarkable feat of playwriting. He is just astonishing. I think the only people who can compare with him at all are maybe Arthur Miller and Eugene O'Neill. He came along and just swept the world when he arrived on Broadway and we discovered his work. He's extraordinary.
Professor Shannon?
August Wilson is our bard. He's a storyteller, gifted storyteller. In the 10 plays which he completed, sadly, you know, having passed away shortly thereafter, but he's left us with a wonderful gift. Interestingly, Mr. Wilson, in a conversation, I recall a conversation with someone saying, now that you have completed the cycle, what will you do next? He said that I'm going to start all over because there are so many untold stories in the Black experience that need to be told. And if I may quote Viola Davis in her acceptance speech recently, she said he had a story to tell. She was of course, referencing her father. And August Wilson told those stories. So, you know, multiply that a million times over. And August Wilson has told the story of the African-American experience. But there's much more to tell.
Yeah. It seems like all of you have, in some way, a kind of a personal connection, whether you met August Wilson or not. Timothy Douglas, it seems like your career is pretty linked to August Wilson.
Oh, yes. I had the good fortune of training as an actor. That was my first profession at Yale Drama School. And my first year as a student was the birth of Ma Rainey's Black Bottom at Yale Repertory Theater, where it premiered. It is and was the practice at Yale Drama School that where appropriate, drama students would understudy the roles at Yale Rep, and I got to understudy Sylvester in the original production of Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. I got to be in the rehearsal room while that play, the late, great Lloyd Richards, his original director, also served as a monumental dramaturg in whittling the play down to where it could be actually staged. So I got to sit in the room, and I knew I was in the presence of greatness, but I was young and very self-centered, and of course, August Wilson wasn't yet August Wilson in all caps. So I just absorbed, and that was the beginning of the journey. The following year, the premiere of Fences, I understudied the role of Gabriel, if you can imagine such a thing. And the following year was Joe Turner's Come and Gone, where I understudied Jeremy and got to
That's
watch.
That's amazing.
That really is.
Oh, you tell me about it.
What do we have to understand, Professor Shannon, about his life, growing up in Pittsburgh as he did? Does that give us a sense of the work that he would create, that experience in Pittsburgh?
I think it's interesting that Pittsburgh in and of itself, in becoming a metaphor, in becoming the central location, in becoming the inspiration for a metaphor for the African-American experience is fascinating. How he weaves his own life experiences into his artwork is fascinating and noteworthy as well. And he does that in the majority of his plays. You know, the triumphs, the joy, the nobility, grounded within the gritty streets, the gritty urban streets of Pittsburgh. Very relatable.
And a specific neighborhood in Pittsburgh, too.
Yeah, the Hill District,
the
yes.
Hill District, which is, I when I went there not too long ago and visited that area, I thought, oh, my gosh, I feel like I know this place.
Right.
What a writer.
I want to ask how you describe his artistic vision. And it seems like one of the characteristics of his work is that he nailed the dialogue, that he had this kind of canny ability to get the dialect right. But he also was a poet. And I wondered if, Professor Shannon, could you talk about those two parts of it, managed
yes.
to get those two together?
Well, let me begin by talking about the early August, when he was basically struggling for an artistic voice, still living in Pittsburgh, around about 20 years old. At the invitation of one of his friends by the name of Claude Purdy, who lived in St. Paul, Minnesota, Wilson left Pittsburgh in search of a way to appreciate the language of that immediate environment of the Hill District. Prior to that, he considered the language mundane, nothing special. So he had to get that sort of like that aesthetic distance that Minnesota gave him to appreciate the language. Hmm. You're absolutely right. His grounding as a poet is so manifest in all of his writings.
Yeah.
You can hear the poetry. And of course, I'm arguing that you cannot understand August Wilson unless you understand what he's writing in terms of poetry. The language comes out of that.
I would have always described his style of writing as almost composing, because it always sounds so musical to me. You listen to it and he said in interviews that blues inspired him and the style of writing he had. And boy, can you hear that in the writing and in Fences particularly. Actually, there's some wonderful passages that it just sort of swells and you can hear how it's written in different voices for as if he were writing for different instruments.
Timothy Douglas, you've described his approach as operatic in style. I'm guessing you're sensing that music too.
Well, operatic in the sense of, in terms of form, how characters will step out, not physically, but structurally step out of a scene and deliver a treatise of their experience in the moment, culminating in the events of the play that they're in. So it's in that sense that I compare it to an aria from an opera. It's grand, it's huge, it requires space. For it to fully resonate to the listener and for the speaker.
One of the things you've mentioned, Bob Mondello, is, and this seems significant, that with August Wilson, we saw on Broadway sharecroppers and taxi drivers and garbage men and
Men and characters we'd never seen on Broadway, characters that Broadway audiences had never seen. And, when he brought the black experience, the African-American experience to Broadway, that was a bit of a novelty at that point. There had been Lorraine Hansberry before him, a few other writers, Raisin in the Sun.
Right.
But it was, what he was doing was unusual. And, I mean, if you think about Fences, the idea of centering a play on a garbage man was kind of remarkable. And putting James Earl Jones in that part would obviously make that more interesting to an audience, but that was a remarkable choice, just among other things. That play, a man who feels unsuccessful in a way, who has two sons and a wife with whom he has a complicated relationship, has been compared to Death of a Salesman.
Yeah.
He did some sort of remarkable things there. But the people that he was putting on stage, I mean, think about what Broadway was like. It's about, the high life. It's about rich people in drawing rooms. This is just not what he was doing.
Professor Shannon, the Century Cycle, he ended up, as has been mentioned, writing one play for each decade in the 20th century. Did he set out to do that, or did it just start to happen that way for him?
It sort of happened, and he did not realize it until perhaps his third play, with Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, Joe Turner's Come and Gone, and Piano Lesson, early to the late 80s when he was in a stretch. That is when I say he was writing while one play was working its way through the circuits, on its way through regional theaters to Broadway. He was writing another play. August Wilson was very much concerned about being what he called a one-shot playwright. That seemed to haunt him, and that propelled him to always have a play in the queue, waiting to be mounted. So that was one of his motivations. But, once he realized that I'm onto something, it's almost as if he packaged himself beautifully.
Right.
And you can see this in the interviews. There's a collection of interviews edited by Jackson Breyer and Mary C. Hartig, Conversations with August Wilson. You can read the interviews chronologically, and you can see August coming into his own. And the beautiful thing about it is that in those interviews, he's very consistent. August Wilson talked about what he was doing. It's a rarity to have artists and writers sit down and answer questions. This is what I'm doing. No, I didn't mean that. This is what I meant. So he was very open in that sense. So you could see the growth from, just being a mediocre poet. And of course, I said this in my initial interview with him, and he raised his eyebrows. But I had read it somewhere. Mr. Wilson, you've been called a mediocre poet. And then ultimately, he did agree with me, and I read some passages of some of the early poems. And he suggested that he was fascinated more so with the sound of the poems, the language, more so than the meaning of it. So I think August Wilson basically, walking down that landscape, which he talks about so often, discovering himself in his art. He didn't know who he was. So I think writing plays became therapy for him. And once he gained confidence, certainly Lord Richards helped him tremendously in terms of being workshopped at the Eugene O'Neill Theater Center and just the encouragement that Lord Richards gave him, certainly gave him the confidence to continue moving forward as a playwright.
Was he interested in the larger sort of historical conclusion? You know what I mean? Was he interested in the sort of historical perspective?
Well, actually, he redefined the term history. August Wilson's definition of history is not what we normally consider to be history. He has said that what I'm trying to do is to rewrite history. In other words, acknowledging those stories that have not been told,
right.
The voiceless masses. He took it upon himself to go in search of those stories that were not told. And oftentimes that search wound up with a blues singer, with the blues. Interestingly, there is an early play. There's a precursor to Ma Rainey's Black Bottom called The Homecoming. It's an early play that Mr. Wilson shared with me when I was writing my book. And if you read it, you can see how the connection that his sympathies lie with the other, the oppressed, the outsider, the person that mainstream society does not embrace. He also wrote a 4-minute play for the Dramatists Guild called The Janitor. And in that play, you know, a janitor was tasked with cleaning an auditorium prior to this huge convention that was about to take place. And the janitor comes upon the microphone and he starts to tell his story. So from early on, August Wilson was the champion of the oppressed, the voiceless, the underprivileged, the other.
I want to ask you about something, Professor Shannon, that you've written along that line. You said that Wilson's work, like Fences, for example, wasn't about blaming white America for its treatment of African Americans, but more about the, here's how you put it, underlying emotional scars that blacks bear. Would you say something more about that, that he wasn't interested in maybe a broader thing, but he wanted to focus it on one character, one story?
Well, I mean, I want to be clear that the racism, you know, he wasn't oblivious to it.
Yeah,
and, you know, it is an underlying current in just about all of his plays. But I think the answer lies within his perspective, what he chooses to focus upon. What's the impact of that racism? What is the impact of being fenced out or shut out of the American dream? What is the impact of human beings striving to achieve what just about all other human beings aspire to? And of course, we can see that on full display in Fences. You know, what is the human cost? One of the interesting things about Fences I saw is that we go down on Troy's job. We see Troy on the job. We can only imagine that in the actual text. And on that job, we saw white faces. We knew very well who was in control of that job. And I think, but it wasn't about that. But I think the director gave us that additional perspective to remind us that that was one of the motivating forces. Perhaps
you're talking about the film version, of course.
Yes, I am.
Sorry.
Yes. And that is exactly what I appreciated about the film version. The perspectives were there, but I think they were fleshed out a little bit better.
We'll come back to the difference maybe between a staged version of Fences and, and the film version of it. Sandra Shannon is with us. She is a scholar of African-American literature, teaches English at Howard University in Washington, D.C. She's in the studios of NPR in Washington, along with NPR arts and film critic Bob Mondello. We also have Timothy Douglas with us. He's the director of Fences for the Pioneer Theater Company. It's his fourth time directing it, as we said. The production opened this past weekend. There's a film version playing at the Broadway Center Cinemas. We'll give you details about all of that on our website at radiowest.org. We will take a quick break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about August Wilson, one of the greatest American playwrights. He was black, and his work was about the black experience in this country. He wrote one play for each decade of the last century, and one of his masterpieces was Fences, which you're hearing a lot about lately because Denzel Washington has a film version of the play now in theaters. But there's also a staged version playing in Salt Lake City. It just opened at the Pioneer Theater Company, which is giving us a chance to talk about August Wilson and the really heartbreaking beauty of his work. Professor Sandra Shannon is the author of The Dramatic Vision of August Wilson. She teaches English at Howard University, joining us from the studios of NPR in Washington, along with Bob Mondello, who is NPR's arts and film critic. And we have Timothy Douglas with us in Portland, Oregon, joining us from a studio. He's the director of Fences for the Pioneer Theater Company. We'll give you details about those productions a little bit later in the program. Sandra Shannon, I wanted to ask you about your interview, your conversation with August Wilson. You mentioned he was generous, not impatient. But it seems like this was interesting. You say when you talk to him that he would sometimes act out the characters when he was answering?
Yes, he would. Yeah, and originally an hour-long interview turned into a two-hour interview, and I found myself having to interrupt Mr. Wilson a couple of times to make sure that I was able to get through my list of questions. But he would easily slip into character, and I have to listen to him very, very carefully to discern whether he's talking about Troy Maxim. Is this August Wilson talking, or is this Troy Maxim talking? Is this Cutler talking? Is this King talking, or August Wilson talking? He knew every single line and would call upon it at certain points.
You write about how when you first read, I guess it was Fences that you first read of August Wilson's work, and then you say you vowed to read pretty much everything else that he had written.
Absolutely. And of course, there's a personal connection for me at that particular time because my own father had passed.
Yeah.
And I write about this in the foreword to my book, The Dramatic Vision of August Wilson. So there were multiple reasons why I was attracted to his work.
In the sense that Troy Maxson, as you've put it, was sort of your father in many ways.
Crude, loving, complex figure. Very much responsible, having raised his four brothers and his sister. He was the oldest child. I could very much relate to that. Myself, having grown up in southeastern Virginia, knew very well the racial climate, of trying to provide for a family in the 50s. I could very much relate to that.
What was it like, Timothy Douglas, to work with August Wilson on a play? What was he very much engaged in the process? Did he sit back at times? I mean, what was it like?
I have two very distinct experiences. The first as, that young understudy in the beginning of his actor training. And I was just a great observer, and I actually didn't hear him talk a lot. He and Lloyd Richards would often sort of go sideline longer discussions as part of the rehearsal process that I was not privy to. But the immediate impact of the clarity of that discussion showed up in the work and the rewrites that he would do along the way. Fast forward to Radio Golf, which I had the great honor of directing the world premiere of, the final play in this cycle. Yeah. Professor Shannon, I remember I would ask specific questions about his goals for a particular scene or the overall story, and he would launch into a story. And within a few minutes, I wasn't sure if we were still talking about the play, if he was answering my question or not. It took me a while to figure out that he indeed was answering my question, but he always answered in the long form of a story, and it was up to me to figure out what I was to do with it. Mm-hmm. At the time, in the heat of the moment of trying to get this play up on its feet, it was a bit frustrating, but there was no doubt that 24/7 I was in the presence of a genius. And so I never questioned the method. I never questioned the content. I questioned if I had enough time to decipher for myself what the answer was so I could continue rehearsals.
Right.
In retrospect, I don't regret a thing. He's such a born storyteller.
It makes sense. It's like, wow.
Yes, and imminently approachable. Anyone, anywhere could go up to him, and he would just hold court and talk as long as you would sit and listen.
Isn't there a bit of Troy Maxim in that? Isn't Troy a born storyteller, too?
I think absolutely, Troy, and I, but all the main male characters. But interestingly enough, recently I've been doing the plays where there are substantial female figures at the center, and I hear him just as clearly through the women as I do through the male. Yeah.
That's a good point. Yes, absolutely.
Let's talk about Fences. Professor Shannon, you first. You've written that for August Wilson, writing Fences was sort of something he wanted to sort of prove that he could raise a single character to a much grander scale. What did he want differently from Fences?
That the play was without question about Troy Maxim. Ma Rainey's Black Bottom got a lot of negative criticism because of what the term used, bifurcated. Critics had difficulty determining who the play was going to be about. First and foremost, they were disappointed that it wasn't a musical. How dare you write a play with Ma Rainey's name in the title and it not be a musical? So some people came to the theater expecting that experience and they did not get it. The play, on the contrary, was not about Ma Rainey. She figured prominently, but ultimately the play was about the band members, the tension among the male band members. So yes, that was the challenge. And not only that, you know, he was early on in his career when he had this support network of people who were cheerleaders egging him on. They probably wagered a bet that you couldn't do this. So he wrote Fences to underscore the fact that, yes, I can raise a single character to an heroic level. And so we get Troy Maxim. Ultimately, in the play, what you have is the other characters are like orbiting around him. Mm-hmm. He is the center of the universe. Rose, his wife, his son, his friend, his mistress.
Yeah, and you could have a whole lot of people rotating around James Earl Jones playing that part because James Earl Jones exerts a gravitational field on stage.
Absolutely.
I saw him originally on Broadway and was just blown away. I mean, the man was astonishing and was holding forth in a fairly large theater, as I recall. Mm-hmm. It was a big space. And, you know, that voice, that fabulous voice and those lines, so that, you know, It was very much his play. There was no question.
Mm-hmm. And so when Rose said, you fill up the space, you got that. But I'm noticing that Denzel put on a couple of pounds. I'm not sure whether that was to compensate filling up that space.
I wondered about that. But Wilson does describe him. I was reading the play this morning. Wilson does describe Troy as a large man, thick, heavy hands. And along with, and this is, I love this, he says, along with his blackness, his largeness informs his sensibilities. Mm-hmm. And the choices he's made in his life. So that idea of filling up space, that largeness, I guess is crucial for the character.
Mm. And of course, his words, never answering. This is, of course, a reflection of August Wilson. You ask him a simple question, he gives you a narrative. Mm-hmm. Why can't we have a TV? He tells a story.
Right.
You know, why am I cheating on you? I saw second base. I wanted to steal second base. Yeah. He gives a story for all of his responses.
Here's Wilson again. He's capable, Troy is, of rising to profound heights of expression. I mean, he's a great talker, Troy is. Bob Mundell, you say that Troy knows he's not important. And so, as you've written, he isn't inclined to let anyone else be important either.
Well, he's certainly not his sons. Right. He won't even go to hear his jazz playing son's concerts. He doesn't want his younger son to do sports. I mean, he is a failed baseball player, or not failed. He came along too soon, and so he was not able to make it in the major leagues. And you get a sense from everyone around him that they see him as a guy who's not willing to let his sons outdo him in some way.
Mm-hmm. I may offer a director's perspective.
Please,
on that.
Of course, yeah.
It's sort of looking on the other side of the mirror. He has been denied by a culture and a race that does not want to see him succeed. And I don't think he's playing that out again. He is now protecting his children from the pain and the frustration and the humiliation of knowing their own self-worth, but inside of a world that will never let it be realized. So I look at Troy as a realist. He understands exactly what has happened to him, and he's doing what he can and what he knows to do based on his education in the world to protect his children.
See, I wondered about... clearly I get that from Troy, but I also wondered if there wasn't also just a petty part, too, that he was just... He didn't want Corey to succeed as a professional football player because he hadn't succeeded as a professional baseball player. Is there any of that?
It becomes a point of interpretation then.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
That you, for me, that's an imposed flaw. Mm-hmm. And that you can assume that. You can still believe it. My perspective is that he's doing what he can consciously to protect his child. Now, sure, unconsciously, subconsciously, maybe it is a way of holding his children back. But yeah. I don't believe that is his conscience motivation. It doesn't matter. You can still read that into it.
Sure.
But at least the actor and the other characters have a chance at fully realizing who they are by the end of the play without having to play into their own destruction.
I really like that interpretation. Yeah, I like that too. A lot. I want to see your production.
Come on down.
On some level, I feel like I have seen, I've at least seen most of the actors. Everyone but the 7-year-old has performed in Washington at some point, and I have been a theater critic here for so long that I've seen all of them. And I love what you're saying about the characters, because that isn't really how you feel about the film. When you watch the film, Denzel Washington, who also directed the film, made some interesting choices and doesn't let him off the hook like that.
Right.
And I'm going to contend that people who see the film do a little bit of homework. I'm going to suggest that's the teacher in me coming out. Mm-hmm. I think knowing some history, knowing some context, bringing some context to understanding Troy's motivations, I think would be very, very helpful. In a sense that the play is deemed a generational play, right? Mm-hmm. You have three generations of Maxim men going back to Troy's father, sharecropper.
Right.
I think it's important to focus upon that historical era and what black men faced. What was it like to be a black man as a sharecropper? What kinds of compensations, what kinds of choices were available to you? I think that's important.
Professor Sandra Shannon, she's the author of The Dramatic Vision of August Wilson. She teaches English at Howard University. She's in the studios of NPR in Washington, along with Bob Mondello, who is, of course, arts critic for NPR. We also have with us Timothy Douglas, who is director of Pioneer Theatre Company's production Offenses, which opened over the weekend. It runs through January 21st. You can get tickets by calling 801-581-6961 or just go to our website for the particulars. We'll take a brief break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation about August Wilson and the production Fences, which just opened at the Pioneer Theatre Company. It runs through January 21st. There's a film version playing at the Broadway Center Cinemas. We'll give you details about all of that a little bit later on the program. I want to play a moment from the play. Corey, his son, who's being scouted for a potential career in college playing football. And he has this exchange with his father when he asks the sort of the most basic question. I want to play these two different versions. First, let's hear James Earl Jones playing Troy, and then we'll also hear after that Denzel Washington's version. Here's from the play Fences.
Can I ask you a question?
What the hell you want to ask me? Mr. Stawicki is the one you got the questions for.
How come you ain't never liked me?
Lacked you. Who in the hell ever said I got to like you. What law is there to say I got to like you? Do you want to stand up in my face and ask me some damn fool-ass question like that? Talk about liking somebody. Come here, boy, when I talk to you. Straighten up, goddammit. Ask you a question. What law is there to say I got to like you?
None.
All right, then. Don't you eat every day? Answer me when I talk to you. Don't you eat every day?
Yeah.
Nigga, as long as you living in my house, you put a sir on the end of it when you talk to me.
Yes, sir.
You eat every day.
Yes, sir.
Got a roof over your head.
Yes, sir.
And clothes on your back.
Yes, sir.
Why do you think that is?
Because of you.
Hell, I know it's because of me. Why do you think that is?
Because you like me.
Like you. I go out of here every morning and bust my butt putting up with them crackers all day long because I like you. You is the biggest fool I ever saw. It is my job. It is my responsibility. You understand that? A man got to take care of his family. You live in my house. You sleep your behind on my bedclothes. You put my food in your belly because you are my son. You are my flesh and blood, not because I like you. It is my duty to take care of you. I owe a responsibility to you. Wait now. Let's get this straight right now. But go along any further. I ain't got to like you. Mr. Rand, don't give me my money come payday because he liked me. He give me because he owe me. Now, I done give you everything I had to give you. I gave you your life. Your mama and me worked it out between us. And lacking your black ass was not a part of the bargain. And don't you try and go through life worried if somebody like you or not. You best make sure that they are doing right by you. You understand what I'm saying, boy?
Yes, sir.
Then you get the hell out of my face and go on down under A&P.
Wow.
Right? Yeah, that is wow.
And the great Courtney B. Vance in the role of Corey.
Let me play. I just want to hear you all talk about the difference in playing it. And also, Timothy Douglas, I want to hear you talk about how you are directing the actor who's playing Troy in your production. Let's hear Denzel Washington. Just for comparison purposes, this is from a stage production where he plays Troy and Chris Chalk plays Corey Maxson.
Let's get this straight right here before I get along any further. I ain't got to like you. Mr. Rand don't give me my money come payday because he liked me. He give it to me because he owed me. I don't give you everything I got to give you. I give you your life. Me and your mama worked that out between us, and liking your black ass wasn't part of the bargain. Now don't you try and go through life worrying about whether somebody liked you or not. You best be making sure they doing right by you. You understand what I'm saying?
Yes, sir.
Then get the hell out of my face and get on down.
I think it's so interesting to hear the audience respond in such different ways. And I'm wondering how malleable that scene could be in from night after night.
Well, you have two things going on. Well, three. If we're listening to an audio recording of both, and there's nothing like being in the room for the experience, you also have a 30-year gap in audiences. And that first time with James Earl Jones, you know, most of us had never heard or experienced anything like the power of August Wilson, construction of words and storytelling through the brilliance of James Earl Jones and Courtney B. Vance. And I think 30 years later, we feel, you know, most theatergoers anyway, have been exposed to Wilson, have done some studying, probably read Professor Shannon's book or certainly heard some of her insights. And so there's a familiarity which would allow for that kind of laughter. That these are just theories. Could be exactly the same experience, and they just found the audience found the second one funny. So yeah, those are my two cents.
Well, he's also playing it faster, and this is Denzel Washington, who is a different kind of star than James Earl Jones, and how to say it? I think the audience feels comfortable with him, like they know him from a lot of different movies. Like there is and the act of seeing a star of his magnitude, and let's note of Viola Davis's magnitude in the same production on Broadway, is a different experience than seeing James Earl Jones all those years ago. And He was a different kind of star. And you could hear, you know, we were talking earlier about him filling up a space. Mm-hmm. Oh, my Lord, you could feel him filling up that space, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, he was just, like, enormous. And Denzel Washington isn't playing it enormous. He's playing it fast mm-hmm. and sharp.
I agree.
And it's a
yes.
different kind of thing.
And, of course, now we have now the voice of Darth Vader.
It's true.
The announcer for CNN, you know. We have a person who has excelled as a Shakespearean figure. And so his voice brings a lot of gravitas.
Yeah, it's iconic
to that role. And add to that, he is a very tall, if I recall, James Earl Jones. His body fills up the space. So his voice equals that space. I think for me, it's what happens after that tirade. James Earl Jones puts his hand on Courtney Vance's shoulder. For me, that clinched it. That was a lesson. There are a number of lessons, life lessons, imparted between a black man and his black son, preparing him to go out into the world, not expecting to be liked, but expecting to be given his due.
And may I just point out that this plays differently in the movie?
Yeah.
I think you're not going to get that kind of laughter at the movie, and partly that's because the pacing in the film is a little faster because you don't have to make room for audience reaction. And Denzel Washington directed this, so he knows what the audience reaction is likely to be, and he paces it in a way that that makes it work the way he wants it to work. And that sequence in the film is clipped and speedy and. I remember feeling it was a lesson, all right. Oh boy,
oh, yeah,
you didn't walk away from that one. His Troy can be bigger on screen in a way than he probably could have been on stage. I didn't see him in the stage version. There are simple camera tricks. He can be bigger and is in a lot of sequences. He feels threatening in a way that I think is how he needs to seem to his son. Viola Davis also looms large. In
yes. Mm-hmm. Well, we have to talk about Rose because it's interesting how the play turns. We don't have to give anything away for those who don't know it. But Bob Mundell, you've talked about the fact that at least in the film version, if I understand this correctly, Denzel Washington gives over, lets the character of Troy go silent for a time and sort of give way for Rose.
Well, I assume that's all in the play. Now, it's been a long time since I read the play, but there is a blowout of a conversation in this conversation is putting it wrong. Excuse me. There is a blowout explosion in the play, and at the end of it, Denzel Washington is left literally speechless. By which I mean Troy is left literally speechless. And what happens is that he's suddenly where he all through this movie he has been acting with his voice, and you've heard him and heard him and heard him, and Viola Davis shuts him down, and at that point he's acting with his eyes, and it becomes just anguished what happens in that sequence. It's a very powerful moment, and I think what is remarkable, I mean, remember that Denzel Washington is directing. Denzel Washington could stay the biggest figure in this movie right to the very end. There are lots of ways of doing that cinematically. He does something I think is very generous in his direction. He hands the movie over to Viola Davis, and it's as Viola Davis takes it to a different place, and Denzel Washington becomes secondary in a movie that he has directed. This is a remarkable thing for a director to do, and I found it very moving watching this.
Timothy Douglas, would you talk about this moment? I want to play this scene. We have the Denzel Washington, Viola Davis version. Would you just talk about this particular moment? This is where Rose asks Troy, you know, what about my life? Would you just talk about this moment?
In that speech, he also uses imagery of planting seeds, waiting for them to grow. And I feel structurally in the story of Fences, that is the very moment where, after waiting for an interminable period of time, those seeds finally do sprout into something that she recognizes and becomes her voice that's forced in that moment. So taking nothing away from the character of Rose and those performances, she truly stands on her own, but it is her choice.
Yes.
Attaching herself, believing in, investing in Troy, and with all of his foibles, and how it comes back to bear on who she has become at this moment in time. It is because of him that this eruption and clarity comes. The way you described what happens in the film, which I haven't seen yet, but by description, it sounds very true to the play, that once Rose has her voice, once she is the, I guess another image is she is the exact mirror in that moment for Troy. He's looking at his life mm-hmm. through this woman that he was devoted to. And what is there to say? Nothing more can be said because the clarity is astounding.
It's not easy for me to admit that I've been standing in the same place for 18 years.
Well, I've been standing with you. I've been right here with you, Troy. I got a life too. I gave 18 years of my life to stand in the same spot as you. Don't you think I ever wanted other things? Don't you think I had dreams and hopes? What about my life? What about me? Don't you think I ever crossed my mind to want to know other men? That I wanted to lay up somewhere and forget about my responsibilities? That I wanted someone to make me laugh so I could feel good? You're not the only one who's got wants and needs, but I held on to you, Troy. I took all my feelings, my wants and needs and dreams, and I buried them inside you. I planted a seed and watched and prayed over. I planted myself inside you and waited to bloom. It didn't take me no 18 years to realize the soil was hard and rocky and it was never going to bloom. But I held on to you, Troy.
It's actually from the film, yeah.
Yeah, that's a film, yeah.
I think the Fences proper, the text itself, leads us to believe that we know this woman. You know, we know her type.
Yeah.
We've seen her before for about half of the play. Mm-hmm. She's very predictable, you know? In the film, she's hanging clothes on the line. She's cooking dinner. She's doing all kinds of domestic, putting food on the table, making sure everybody's fed. You know, she fits into that 1950s wife, mother, cult of domesticity, or whatever you might want to call it. And so Wilson does that beautifully. He takes us down one road, and then all of a sudden he brings you back.
Yeah.
This woman has a life, which leads you to believe that there are a lot of things that are not said. People that you use the word, I think Timothy used the word choose. I think that's a very key word. That a lot of these women in relationships, of course, when divorce was not as prevalent mm-hmm. as it is now, they choose the situations that they live in. And in doing so, that empowers them. They're not victims. And I think this is a surprise to Troy, because as I recall in that scene, his mouth flies open.
Yeah.
It's like, who is this woman? Because even he has been fooled to think that she is, you know, the stereotypical wife, loving, supportive wife and mother. But she clearly pivots at that point and grows in stature.
You know, it was a different word that Timothy used that I was glomming onto at that moment, which is aria. That is an aria.
It's
oh,
true.
My Lord.
Yes.
What that speech is just, whoa. It's
a pivotal point.
Yeah.
Timothy Douglas, I want to have you finally make a case for having people come see the staged version. Not that you need to pit the film version against the staged version, but why do you figure it's important, as I kind of do, that people see it on stage?
That's a big question. So as with all of my experiences with August, they were quite personal, so I'll speak from the personal. Many of the plays in the American Century cycle, at least that take my attention, is the relationship between father and son, or father figure and son figure. I come back to this play many years after getting to share it with my father. My parents were not theater goers, but they would come to support me. And, you know, I got to have my father sit in rehearsals for this play and actually come to see it and have some dialogue about it. I lost my father this past March, and coming back to not only Fences, but it comes on the heels of a production of Seven Guitars and Jitney that I've just done, 1, 2, 3 in a row, fathers and sons, constantly. Mm. This play spoke through my father this time. Mm. And I don't so much direct as honor the impact and the stimulus that the play brings me. And I do what I can to clarify that for the cast so they can make appropriate choices based on their understanding of the play and the journey. Michael Anthony Williams, who is playing Troy at the Pioneer Theater production, is very, very close to his father right now, who is of advanced age and something that is on his mind constantly. The coming together of the stories of our fathers, being black sons of black fathers and being adults and having had some experiences and having been through productions of Fences before, it was remarkable to the both of us how not different, but how augmented and alternative angles this play has revealed to us working on this production. So see it, because like all good theater, it's quite personal. And then specifically the dance of this director and that actor honoring our fathers and the great father playwright August Wilson through this production, that radiates not only through Troy but throughout the entire extraordinary ensemble there. And the audiences have been quite generous, and in that they bring themselves to it, they open themselves to it. Though specifically about black Americans, they see and feel themselves in it. And it's been such a privilege to be able to work on this production in particular, which I dedicate to my father, Eugene.
It's Timothy Douglas. He directs Pioneer Theatre Company's production of Fences. It opened over the weekend, runs through January 21st. Tickets are available by calling 801-581-6961. We have those details on our website as well. Timothy Douglas, thanks very much for taking the time.
Oh, my pleasure.
Professor Sandra Shannon is the author of The Dramatic Vision of August Wilson, teaches English at Howard University in Washington, D.C. Professor, thank you very much.
It's an honor.
And NPR's arts and film critic, Bob Mondello. Bob, thank you so much as well.
Doug, it's always a pleasure.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction today from Michael Havey. The show produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.